My guest is David O'Sullivan. David O'Sullivan is EU sanctions envoy, a position he's held since January 2023. Welcome to the podcast, David.
Thank you, Paul.
Before we dig deep into your role as this envoy, which is a relatively new position, I'd like you to tell us a bit more how EU sanctions policy fits into the broader strategy, how the European Union is dealing with Russia, especially since its illegal invasion of Ukraine 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think indeed it is important to underline what a kind of existential moment the full-scale invasion of Ukraine was for all of us, I think. Clearly, we kind of misunderstood a bit what was happening in Georgia in 2008, even the annexation of Crimea, and that was clearly crossing a line in terms of clearly annexing the part of another country. But people still sort of somehow thought this was exceptional and could be managed. And even though we had sanctions, I don't think people saw it as an existential threat. The full-scale invasion of Ukraine, of course, there was the war between 2014 and 2022, and we should not forget that, I can't remember now, 13 or 14,000 people died.
Right.
So it was quite a significant conflict. But again, it looked like a kind of regional issue, border dispute, etc., and people thought it could be contained. It was only, I think, really with, you know, 200,000 Russian troops crossing the frontier and launching clearly an effort to get to Kyiv, to displace the legitimately elected government, to take over the country and effectively turn it into a puppet state, that people realized the enormity of what was happening and the transformation of the security situation in Europe, which this represented. So hence the enormity of the response, which is, you know, I think, unprecedented. You mentioned the overall context. I mean, firstly, there was the military assistance, which is considerable. Some will say maybe not enough, maybe not fast enough, but still it's considerable. Secondly, there's the macroeconomic and humanitarian aid, so there's the money. Thirdly, there is the general political support and the sense of giving the Ukrainian people a bit of hope for the future, which I think was represented by the decision to accept it as a candidate country and basically to start accession negotiations to give them a perspective that there was a future for this country and clearly a European future. And then fourthly, you had the sanctions. I'm not saying in which order these came,
because
the sanctions, in fact, were perhaps the shock and awe was the immediate announcement of the sanctions sort of the day after. But it is all four of these things need to be seen together, I think, as part of our strong statement of support for Ukraine in resisting this Russian aggression. But more importantly, sending a message to Russia that this attempt to change the way we do business in Europe will not be accepted.
Well, as you say, there's been some kind of EU sanctions policy towards Russia since Georgia and Crimea, so going back 15 years or so. But am I right in saying you're the first EU envoy for sanctions? Is that correct?
I am. I mean, I'm not entirely sure what that means, but...
But why have one now, then?
Well,
that's my question.
Well, when I was asked to take over this role, we were basically trying to create a sort of counterpart to a similar role in other G7 countries, notably the US, the UK, where they had appointed someone to be the sort of external face of sanctions policy. And in particular, my role was designed to be the external outreach. So going to countries who had not aligned on our sanctions and addressing with them issues of possible circumvention or sanctions evasion, which was happening on their territory.
Right.
And that was the primary focus. I mean, a secondary consequence of that is I have become a sort of informal point of coordination with the G7, with my then counterpart in the United States, Jim O'Brien,
right,
who has since moved on to replace Karen Dunfried as Assistant Secretary in the Department of State.
Yeah.
There was a UK colleague, Kumar Iyer, who was in charge of sanctions in the Foreign Office. He has since been, he's moved on to other things, but his deputy, David Reed, is someone I interact a lot with.
Okay.
So it was part of I have become a general point of contact. But the main focus of that is the external dimension of our sanctions as it relates to countries who have not aligned on our sanctions.
So you talk about circumvention happening in certain territories. How do you go about then making your views known to these countries, these territories where evasion, circumvention might be happening? How straightforward are those démarches?
Well, they're fairly straightforward. I mean, I think it's important to distinguish between two categories of countries, because we should not lose sight of the fact that two of the countries with whom I've had dealings in the past year are candidate countries,
right,
who have chosen not to align with our sanctions, but whom we would have normally expected would have done so. And that's Serbia and Turkey as right. candidate countries. It is part of the process of being a part of the situation of being a candidate country that we expect a high degree of alignment with CFSP and particularly sanctions. So these are two countries where my starting point is to say, well, actually, you should be aligned on our sanctions.
Yes.
For other countries who are not candidate countries and who basically say, we don't adopt unilateral sanctions and our sanctions are autonomous sanctions and unilateral because we could not get UN cover for our sanctions. And this is an important point to understand, that normally we prefer to have UN cover. Mm-hmm. And for example, against Iran or against DPRK, we've always had a UN cover for the sanctions, and therefore we've been entitled to expect the entire world to support us. On this occasion, for obvious reasons, Russia is a permanent member of the Security Council, declined, of course, to sanction itself. Mm-hmm. We couldn't get UN cover. So when countries say, you know, we don't support autonomous sanctions, my reply is, well, actually, we don't like them either, but we've no choice in this situation. Now, what did we then do? When I first started here, the colleagues in DG Trade and DG FISMA, the financial services DG, who are responsible for sanctions, had already done a preliminary look at trade flows. And it was fairly crude, but fairly telling. Trade, which previously had gone from us to Russia, was now going in large quantities, much larger than previously, to other countries in the region, and from there to Russia. So classic transshipment of sanctioned goods, which couldn't go directly, and we're now going via these countries. So this threw up a first list right. of countries of interest, shall we say.
Yes.
So it was Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkey, Serbia, UAE. These were the first list of countries that kind of the numbers generated. And it was a mechanical calculation. It wasn't a yeah. question of a political choice. And yes, we literally, I would contact these countries and say, I want to come and see you and talk about this situation, what we can do about it.
And how does the conversation then take place? I'm intrigued. You make it a bit generic if you can't talk about specifics in terms of they know what they're doing clearly and you know what you're trying to achieve, but obviously the two sides don't necessarily converge. So how does a conversation develop?
Well, the conversation develops very simply. They will also say, all of these countries, we don't want to be a platform for circumvention, and we particularly don't want to be a platform for circumvention of products which may enter the Russian military machine.
Okay.
And so we were able to break down our analysis of the products which were transshipping and identify a particular subset which was going directly into the Russian military machine. This is what we call the battlefield products. The formal title is the Common High Priority List, which is, to bore you with some of the detail, 50 HS codes at 6 digits, probably represents about 300 products. But these were items which the Ukrainian colleagues, who had painstakingly dissected Russian military kit, missiles, drones, artillery shells, and so forth, and found these components, which would normally be fairly innocent in a civilian context, chips, integrated circuits, optical readers, flash memory cards, but which were making Russian missiles more accurate, more lethal, making drones able to work better and become more lethal, and the same for other pieces.
So the whole dual use debate.
Well, exactly. But some of these would be dual use. Many would not be dual use under the classic OECD Wassenaar international arrangement.
Okay.
And so I would go to these countries and I would say, are you aware that you are transshipping a significant quantity of these products which are going into the Russian military machine? And that was a conversation which actually was much less controversial than you might imagine. Most people said, actually, that's trade we don't want to be involved in.
Do they plead ignorance though, in those situations? They had no idea.
Well, they
claim to have no idea.
In fairness, most of these countries probably were not initially aware of exactly what was transiting, okay. and they certainly didn't know, in fairness to them, that these goods were so easily found on the battlefield. That was something we brought to them and said, "Here's the evidence. And then they would say, yeah, okay, I get that. And indeed, we don't want to be responsible for helping the Russian military kill innocent civilians in Ukraine. And nearly all of these countries, in one way or another, have now taken action to stop the transshipment of these products through their territory.
I know that you, like any part of EU policy and elsewhere, that you have your critics, people say sanctions aren't working, and starting with the European Parliament. I know that Josep Borrell, the High Representative, is very keen to put the record straight. But how do you measure success? How do you counter these critics that sanctions, broadly speaking, are not working?
Well, I'll spare you my sanctions are working speech, which would take another 20, 25 minutes. For me, it's relatively simple. You look at what your objectives are. Our objective is, first of all, to deny Russia the technology needed to make sophisticated military kit. Secondly, to deny the Russian government the revenue to continue to fund this war. And thirdly, to impose a high price on the Russian economy more generally in response to their aggression. If I look at all three of these objectives, we have had success. On the advanced technology, we have succeeded in making it harder and harder for Russia to obtain the advanced technology from the West that they used to get very easily. There is circumvention. Some of it is still getting through, of course. But the objective is to make it harder, to make it slower, and make it more expensive. And I think we can see that we're doing that. We're shutting off avenues of circumvention. We're forcing Russia to create new, longer, slower. The supply chain is less reliable and it costs more. So in that regard, we have had some success. Regarding the revenue, we have basically deprived Russia of some 400 billion euros of money which they could otherwise have spent on the war. About 300 billion of that are the central bank assets which we have immobilized in the G7, the bulk of which are in Europe, about 210 billion. And about 100 billion is the loss of revenue, particularly through the oil price cap and the fact that Russia is not able to sell its oil and gas at market prices or at the same prices it was able to get. And finally, in terms of the overall cost to the Russian economy, what used to be a government surplus is now a government deficit. 30% of their public spending is going on defense, nearly 6% of GDP. They are forced into cannibalizing their productive economy, social welfare, education, their national welfare fund, which they've had to nearly take 20% of to continue funding. So this is all going into military production, missiles, weapons, and so forth, which is unproductive, which is, you know, being destroyed on the battlefields of Ukraine. And meanwhile, the sort of medium-term perspective for the production, for the productive capacity of the Russian economy is being seriously damaged. Their labor market is in deep trouble. Some 1 million of the best and brightest have left. You see them in the cafe bars of Tashkent and Bishkek and Astana, you know, with their laptops creating startups in those countries. Right. They're not going to go back to Russia. At the lower end of the scale, the unskilled labor, they have a massive labor shortage caused partly by the mobilization. And so there's a massive shortage in agriculture, in construction. So the Russian economy is in bad shape, and this is a direct consequence of our sanctions. And it is not immediately, I think this is the key point, it's not immediately impacting on their ability to wage the war this week or next week, unfortunately. And that's a problem for us, because we would have wished to impact more quickly. But, you know, somewhere in the next 12 to 18 months, they're going to hit a real economic obstacle to maintaining the intensity with which they are spending money on this war.
But before we get to that point, though, before Russia gets to that point, how creative is Russia and its allies in circumventing your sanctions? And do you have a feeling that sometimes there's a bit of whack-a-mole? You close off one avenue and then another one pops up somewhere else.
Of course. But, I mean, where there is sanctions, there is circumvention. It's like the war on drugs.
Yeah.
To imagine that you will impose sanctions 100%, watertight, no leakage, no circumvention, is an illusion. I repeat, the objective, the game between Russia and us, and it's not a game because it's costing lives in Ukraine, but the struggle is their ability to create channels of circumvention and our ability to shut it down.
All right.
And as we do it, making it harder, slower, more expensive, That's the every success we have is when we shut off another channel of circumvention, and then they will create another. But it's more expensive. It's less reliable, and it makes it more and more difficult for them to procure the goods that they previously could get very easily from us.
And as the war drags on now into its third year, people often describing it rightly or wrongly as a war of attrition. Notwithstanding the debate, which is well known inside the European Union, about what level of support and for how long should be given by the EU to Ukraine, obviously, in this effort, how difficult is it ongoing to maintain a united front within the EU on sanctions themselves and how they are drafted and developed?
Look, unanimity is always a challenge, right?
I mean, you need unanimity.
Yes.
All right.
And sanctions are decided by unanimity. It's one of the elements in the passerelle which could move to QMV, along with
qualified majority voting.
Qualified majority voting for the non-specialists. It's one of the there are three elements that are identified in the treaty: sanctions, declarations, and military missions. Human rights declarations and military missions. Mm. There have been many times people have recommended that we should, by unanimously, decide that we no longer need unanimity and that we can do this by qualified majority. My personal view is that's what we should do. I think deciding something like this by unanimity is extremely cumbersome, but that's where we are. And honestly, the miracle, the story here, is how we have still managed to put in place the most comprehensive package of sanctions against a country we've ever seen.
Right.
And that I take no credit for that. That was done even before I arrived. I think when I arrived, we were on the cusp of the 10th package.
Right.
And what the colleagues in the Commission, colleagues in DG FISMA, the colleagues in DG Trade, and DG TechSud had managed to do in terms of crafting and getting adopted unanimously in the Council 10 packages under the leadership of President von der Leyen and her chief of staff has been, honestly, looking at it from outside, I was astounded that they could do this. Hmm. So I think the success, the story is not, oh, well, it's very difficult and it's getting more difficult. The story is we've managed to do it and we still get unanimity, and we just had the 13th package. We're now starting work on a 14th, probably. It's always difficult, but we have managed, and we have sanctions in place which cover 60% of our previous imports from Russia and 58% of our previous exports. We've never had sanctions like this against any country in the history of the EU.
And to what extent, it's not so much on the effectiveness of sanctions, but how much pushback do you get within the European Union about the negative impact on the EU of these economic sanctions? It's not totally, obviously, a one-way street, correct?
No, and it was certainly more costly for us than it was, say, for the Americans, because we traded 15 times more than the US. We obviously had a heavy energy dependence, which we've now kind of weaned ourselves off. I mean, that's another massive success story and remarkable miracle, is how quickly we managed to reduce what was, you know, I don't know, 45% dependence for gas and I think 25-30% dependence for oil, and we're now down in single digits in both cases. That was remarkable. But it was more painful for us, and I don't underestimate that for some companies it was very difficult. Some companies probably depended on Russia for 80% of their exports. And I'm not talking necessarily about the big names. I'm talking about the Mittelstand in Germany or the small family companies in northern Italy who produce high-quality goods for whom Russia was a major point of export. Many of these companies have had to readjust. The reality, I think, is nonetheless that they have. That, right. I mean, in the end, Russia is not such a big economy. It's a wide world out there. There are alternative markets, and many of these companies have now adjusted. And I think the psychological adjustment is that Russia is now being written out of the equation, both as a source of imports and as a source of exports, because people no longer see it as a promising market or a reliable supplier. And unfortunately, and this is going to be very damaging for Russia going forward, I don't believe people will reverse those decisions anytime soon, even if you were to have a cessation of hostilities and an end to all sanctions. And by the way, I don't think that's likely to happen anytime soon.
You mentioned at the very beginning this coordination role you have as well with the G7 and the United States. As we all know, this is the year of elections, a lot of change here in Brussels, obviously, new commission taking office in the year. General election in the UK, big elections in the United States. Do you have any kind of, without being maybe too specific, contingency plans, given there'll be quite a potential, quite a big moving of personalities in these top jobs in the next few months?
Listen, you play the ball that's in front of you, right? Yeah. We are dealing with the politics we have at the moment. As you say, there are all these elections, democratic moments. Democracy is what this is all about, right? That's the difference between us and Russia, notwithstanding Mr. Putin's stunning victory in the elections. And we will deal with, you know, what we find after the elections when we find it. And we may have to adjust, I agree. But for the moment, we're working, you know, on the trajectory we're on until such time as somebody somewhere proposes with authority a different direction. And I still think that certainly within the European Union, the existential threat posed by Putin's aggression and the clear evidence that this is not just about Ukraine for him, in everything he has said and everything he is doing, it's obvious that if he were to win in Ukraine, it would just be a question of where would he go next.
Right.
And that has to, honestly, put the fear of God into all the rest of us.
Yep.
And we have to prepare for that situation. So this is not just about Ukraine.
Yeah.
And we need to remember that. We're not just doing this to help the people of Ukraine. We should do it to help the people of Ukraine, who have been incredibly courageous and shown huge resilience in face of, you know, massive aggression. But the fact is, we're also doing it for ourselves.
A final question, David. You mentioned earlier also this immobilization of assets, what I think in the vernacular we'd call freezing of assets.
Well, there is a difference.
It's okay. The two-thirds of which are in the EU, so roughly, you just mentioned this figure, 210 billion euros. I think I'm right in saying there's quite an ongoing debate within the European Union about what to do with these immobilized assets, whether one can somehow repatriate them. What is this current state of play? It's all well to say we've immobilized 210 billion euros of assets from the Russian Central Bank, but then what?
Well, I think the most important thing is that Russia is not able to access this money at the moment and won't be for some time soon. So that's part of the
the
depriving the Russian government of revenue needed to fund the war. And I think everyone agrees that, you know, this money is not going to be given back anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other thing on which we're all agreed is that one way or another, this money will be leveraged to provide a future support to Ukraine for reconstruction. Now, whether that is seizing those assets and spending them, or whether it is using them as leverage to get other money from Russia to pay for reconstruction, that's a debate that's ongoing. There are some who advocate seizing this money.
Some inside the EU.
Some inside the EU, some outside the EU.
Yeah.
There is a legitimate, I think, debate about two issues which arise. One is the legality of the exercise, and there are many who think that these are sovereign assets, sovereign central bank assets, benefiting from a degree of sovereign immunity, and that it is legally hazardous to go against that. The lawyers are poring over it to see. There are lawyers in the US and some other non-lawyers like Larry Summers and Bob Zelig who've come out and said, no, there's a clear legal doctrine of countermeasures that you could use.
Yeah.
I think meant that just as in any legal debate, you'll find lawyers who say, well, no, that doesn't work.
In this case, yeah.
In this case. And then you have the precedent value, the systemic risk. So you seize the sovereign assets of a country who has deposited their money in your banks. What is the risk that others would say, oh, well, if that's the case, my money isn't secure in these locations. I prefer to keep it elsewhere. So these are the elements in the debate. And we need to work our way through. The G7 are working on it. They've created three working groups, which looks at these legal issues, the systemic issues, and the use that might be made of this money.
Right.
A definitive conclusion has not been reached. I don't think there is a huge urgency to decide this, because it's not a debate of do we seize it or do we give it back. The money is where it is, and it's going to stay there for a long time until there's some resolution of this issue down the road. We have the option at any stage, if we feel legally secure and we've addressed the systemic risk and we're comfortable doing it, we can do it. If not, in any event, the money's not going anywhere. Now, what we have done at European level, and I think this is very important, we have moved on the windfall profits,
right,
which from these assets which are held particularly in a company that many people had never heard of before called Euroclear, which is a sort of asset management company here in Brussels, which holds about 190 billion of these assets. And the way the thing is structured, there is a kind of, because the assets are immobilized, there's windfall profits which accrue to the company,
right,
of around three and a half, 4 billion a year, roughly. And we have proposed to take this money and to use it to assist Ukraine, and the idea being, indeed, maybe even to use for military assistance.
And there's less debate about that.
There's no legal debate about this, right, because this money is not Russian. It sort of maybe belongs to the company, but the company is not insisting on keeping it, so that the legal base is very solid for using these windfall profits, and we are moving ahead with that. The Commission made a proposal last week. It was discussed at the European Council. We'll probably need a few more discussions, but the idea is fairly soon to be able to put this money at the disposal of the Ukrainians, and indeed, if at all possible, to use it for military kit, which the Ukrainians so desperately need for ammunition and air defense and the other military material, which we can see they so desperately need.
Okay, well, we have to leave it there. David O'Sullivan, thank you very much for your time.
Been my pleasure. Thank you.